Hello, my name is Chris Malmberg. Welcome to the Book Spider Podcast. The Book Spider Podcast is a book analysis podcast where I and my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger, use our special literature-paralyzing and theme-liquefying venoms to seize and digest works of fiction before regurgitating what we think we've learned into your waiting ears. We like to pay special attention to how these books connect to each other and try to draw connections between the books we've read recently. This week, we're discussing Waterland by Graham Swift. In Waterland, we get the story from Tom Crick, a teacher of history in the 80s, who is about to be fired. He's about to be fired for a couple reasons. One, the headmaster at his school isn't convinced knowledge of history is at all useful. And two, Crick's wife recently stole a baby. In an act of defiance, Crick deviates from the lesson plan to tell his students about the history of his family and the land in which he grew up, the Fens, focusing specifically on one summer during his teenage years in the 1930s when the war with Germany loomed on the horizon, as nuclear war with Russia now looms on the horizon for the teenagers in his class. This story reveals the tragic sequence of events that led to Crick's now wife becoming barren, perhaps explaining her recent widely publicized kidnapping offense, but is as much an attempt for Crick to confront what his headmaster has accused his field of, that knowing history makes no difference because we never escape nor learn from it. So I wanted to ask both of you what history is in this novel. History as a concept comes up in different ways. We're also covering a lot of history in the novel. And it feels as though history accrues some kind of thematic weight. And I was wondering about each of your takes on what that is.
Well, I have a little quote from page 140. There's no audiobook available, so I borrowed it from the library, and I have the book in front of me. So Crick is in his class doing his thing, teaching the kids about his own history of, growing up around the River Leam and like the history of the fictional river and whatnot. And he has this student named Price, who's always kind of like nagging at him, and maybe nagging's not the right word, but questioning him and like, why are we doing this? Like, I want to learn something. And in the middle of one of these excursions into the history of the Waterland, the Fens, Crick says, "I'm speculating it's true, Price, but we're all free to interpret." Price says, "You mean so we can find whatever meaning we like in history?" And, Crick thinks, I do believe that. I believe it more and more. History, a lucky dip of meanings. Events elude meaning, but we look for meaning. Another definition of man. The animal who craves meaning but knows, and maybe that like cut off but knows means like but knows he can never get any meaning, or knows he can never have any objective meaning or objective truth about history. So I at least think there's some kind of key to what the book says about history in that passage, as well as obviously in the circuitous style, the book starts off pretty close to the incident of finding Freddie's body in one of the canals, and like the book keeps circling back and forth between like that time and then you know, Crick's classroom time, and then, you know, so it does this really convoluted thing where it never tells the narrative from point A in history to point B. So I definitely think those two are related. I'm not exactly sure, other than saying like history can be whatever we want it to mean. I'm not sure, like, that might not be exhaustive of what the novel is saying about history, but certainly that's a good place to start. And, you know, I'll try not to like quibble with this, even though it's utterly ridiculous and false, but, you know, that's what the novel presents.
I don't know if I have an easy definition handy for how the novel would define history, to the extent that, you know, I don't know if I can articulate off the top of my head a definition that is radically different from the way that most people would understand that term. I do wonder if there's not some, and maybe this is so obvious that it's not worthwhile to bring it up even, but like, is there some metaphorical resonance between the kind of the focus on a river, the imagistic focus on rivers and waters and silt, and the way, you know, at one point he talks about the way kind of the way silt accrues, right? The work of silt dredging and history, right? I mean, particularly the way in which Patrick, you mentioned the meandering path of how events are presented in this novel. Is there metaphorical resonance between that and the meandering path of a river? And is there metaphorical resonance between the dredger dredging the silt that accrues as water progresses, and the historian dredging up the history of the past? And I guess if there is that metaphorical resonance, does that metaphor carry meaning, or is it there for kind of aesthetic elegance without necessarily providing understanding?
That's interesting. That's a hard question for me to respond to. You know, Chris, obviously maybe you have your own response. I find it hard to respond to simply because, like, whatever it is that this novel is saying about history, I'm almost positive I think it's wrong. Like, what it's saying is incorrect. So I find myself, I definitely think it's interesting, like, if the book thinks that history meanders like a river, or like that, like a quote on page 146, you know, where Crick mentions that Heraclitus of Ephesus said that we cannot step into the same river twice, but then he says, no, we always are stepping into the same river over and over again. So I definitely think that metaphor of the meandering river and returning to the same spot in the river is definitely there for, you know, technique, craft, elegance. But I definitely don't know if it is saying anything about history that is either non-trivial or like counterintuitive. I don't know.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, I don't know if I have. You said that pretty well. Nothing about history that's non-trivial or counterintuitive. And yeah, I don't know if there's anything that the novel says about the nature of history that seems revelatory to me. That might partly be because the the lives of all these people don't feel like real human lives to me, right? Like these people all live, these people live in the register of myth. All their experiences occur in the register of myth, practically.
Right.
And so, yeah, and so it's very hard for the text to say anything credible about history as it's lived and experienced in the real world when all its characters are... Like the history, the life as it's lived by these characters takes place and is thought of in this way that doesn't really, that, that seems several levels of weirdness and symbolic intensity and implausibility ratcheted up. It's ratcheted up several levels in those things from real life, right? Which is why whatever critique it has of history... It's hard for it to make a critique of history when its characters don't live history as humans normally experience it.
Right.
Or, yeah, I mean, maybe it's not hard to make a critique, but it, I am not able to tease one out, I think, partly for that reason.
Right. And I find it interesting, like, Chris, that you chose this book right after we read Coming Up for Air. They're about, you know... Coming Up for Air is about pre-World War One more than... it's kind of about both pre-World War One and pre-World War Two, and this one takes place, like, mostly during World War Two, but otherwise, it's, like, you couldn't find a more different stylist from Orwell than guy, right? Like, you know, like, the style is so different. Orwell, you know, As people commonly say of Orwell, you know, and as he said of his own writing, you know, he was attempting to be as transparent as a window. And this, like you said, Hans, is in this very mythical register and, you know, more along the lines of you know, like, I guess Cormac McCarthy writes in a similarly mythic register, although for different purposes, obviously. I think that mythic register, like, it, to me, it seems strained. Like, I think that it, for me, for my part, it really interfered with my absorption of the novel.
When I say mythic register, there are two things that I mean by that, right? Or two kind of observations that ties to, right? One of those has to do with style, where there's a way that the narrator Crick is talking, and one of those has to do with the actual, like, on a just the level of events, the things that are happening don't really feel like things that happen quite in the real world, right? So it's a question of both content at the level of event and style. So just to clarify what we mean by mythic register, right? I think, like, both of those are in some sense mythic, but I'd want to make that distinction. I mean, I think you could narrate some of these events in a much more plain spoken way, right?
Right.
And they would still be events that had the register of myth, even if they were narrated in a more plain spoken way. And yeah, as far as the question of, I mean, my sense, Patrick, is what you're saying is the style of the narration tried your patience.
Oh yeah,
and it honestly tried my patience too on the third read. Right, like, I really, really, this is the third time I had read it. The first two were about 10 years ago, and I really, really enjoyed it the first two times. I really admired it the first two times. I think that, I mean, for me, part of the issue was just that I remembered it pretty well, right? Like, I happened to read it twice in a setting where I was institutionally required to, like, commit most of the main events and themes to memory. So there was no real surprise. And in the absence of any kind of suspense or narrative surprise, I think that the patience-trying aspects of the style become much more pronounced.
What, I mean, this would get off topic a little bit, but I'm like, I really want to know, you described it, your original reads as suspenseful. This was my original read, and what's the suspense?
Well, maybe suspense isn't quite the right word, right? I mean, there's... We have a pretty clear sense early on of the broad strokes of what's happened, and the question becomes filling in the details of why it happened and what the texture of that experience was like, right? So, like, we know from the beginning that... We know from the beginning that Mary lost her, that Mary is not able to have a baby, and, you know, that she was pregnant as a teenager and did not have that child, right? But we don't get the scene of her, you know, having the fetus sucked out through a straw by a witch. We don't get until the end. And so it's right. You made, I think, Chris, in your questions that you sent us ahead of time, you made a comparison to Beloved, right? Where with Beloved, there's a kind of narrative technique of skirting around and gradually spiraling in toward some kind of core horror, right? In Beloved, it's, you know, Beloved cutting her infant's head off with the saw. In spoilers for Beloved, I guess. In this, it's I mean, there are a few things that are kind of skirted and circled around and then spiraled down into the heart of, right? But the really kind of core thing is the witch sucking the fetus out with the straw, right? And so when I say suspense, I don't mean maybe suspense in the conventional sense of, like, can the hero get out of the, you know, can the hero escape the bad guy before they cut him up with the saw? More in the sense of, like, just there is information being withheld from us that will have impact when it is revealed, right? So in the absence of that, right, where, you know, if you read this and you know all the time what it is he's hinting at as he's hinting, the hints become less appealing, right? And I mean, it sounds to me like you didn't enjoy it much even without the, I don't know if you want to call that suspense exactly, but without the possibility of revelation, you still didn't enjoy it much.
No, I probably hated this more than any other book we have read so far. Except maybe,
really?
It's awful.
Oh, it's interesting.
It's not awful. I think it's well done. Like, I think the guy, what he wants to do, he's doing, and he's doing it really well. You know, he's doing it artfully. It's just what he's doing is not interesting to me. And, like, kind of, it took me a long time to realize this about myself, but, like, it's kind of the exact opposite experience that I want to create in my own writing and that I want to have when I'm reading. Like, this is not the kind of experience I want at all.
What aspects of the experience are opposite for you?
Well, I've already said, like, the I found the mythic style very, very strained. But mostly it was the circuitous nature of the narrative, and, like, you know, the pretense at saying something about history that really turned me off. Like, you know, I just, like, there's no accounting for taste, but, you know, just, like, I just find myself feeling more and more cold about work that tries to subvert narrative form in some way, you know? Like, I just don't think it's... I don't... Like, I'm not sure what the point is of trying to subvert narrative form. Like, because it to me, it seems like trying to subvert narrative form, the most it can do is say something about narrative. And, like, I just, you know, I don't necessarily care about, like, what's being said about narrative. I'm not sure that question, like, I don't think that question interests me that much. Like, it may be true that like we shouldn't think of our own lives as a narrative, but that doesn't mean that it may not be real, like actually realistic to just write a straight narrative, but it's still like a necessary art, I would say. Mm. I don't know. I'm rambling a little bit.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is a little bit is that it's overwrought
in overwrought.
That it doesn't earn the right to be serious about the things that it's saying it's serious about.
Mm. Yeah, I think we could say it that way if we wanted. I don't know.
No,
Patrick, do you feel like you made your own damn point well enough and Chris doesn't need to come in and paraphrase it for you?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, you can, please.
No, it's not that I disagree. Overwrought, yeah. I would say it's overwrought. I would say it's strained. I would say that we could be doing, like, he's clearly has a lot of talent and skill, and we could be doing something so much better and more important if we didn't bother with the trivial question of what narrative is. And I don't know, like, maybe that's not a question like that an MFA person like myself should be bothered by, you know, and it used to be a question that I found very interesting. Like, how can we subvert narrative form? How can we undermine, like, our expectations about how stories unfold? But it's just not a question that interests me anymore. And more than that, it's not that it no longer interests me. It also irritates me when people ask it like they can uncover a new answer.
When you say subvert narrative form, what could you could you say like what you mean by subvert narrative form and maybe like other examples?
Let's just take coming up for air, very traditional narrative form in that, like, you know, the guy starts at one point and he has some memories. And then after those memories, he has an experience and it ends up, well, I've got to take my medicine and I'll just say I cheated on my wife. Like, I just take it. So that's pretty traditional to, like, start at point X, move forward a little bit to point Y, and then look back to point T, and then move forward again to point Z. Does that make sense?
Sure.
And that's pretty traditional. And another traditional form is just to start at X, move to Y, and then move to Z without any flashbacks, really. So, you know, so that's another traditional form. And, you know, we could find a form similar to coming up for air in Homer's Odyssey, actually. We start at point X, we go to point Y where we meet Odysseus for the first time and he's shipwrecked. Then he goes back to the beginning and tells it all, and then we go to point Z. But this one is like, let's start at point X, go to point Y, go back to point X, go to point T, then go to point, you know, well, really go to point like C, then D, then E. Then now, maybe back to C.
I think you might be... I take your point, first of all. And I think that your... I think your critique is a reasonable one, right?
Okay.
And I probably... Chris, I don't know... I can't really tell if you enjoyed reading this a third time. I guess I'm curious just briefly if you did. And then I do have a response I want to make to Patrick's point.
Yeah. I definitely didn't enjoy it as much as I did when I first read it. I attributed it to the things that I was struggling with to the voice and to the frame. The frame being Tom Crick telling all of this to his students, which feels, I remember, and I think I wrote this in my question, when I first read it, and even like the second time through, this is my third time through it as well, Hans, I admired it for kind of not really caring to make a whole lot of sense. It felt ostentatious and interesting to basically have this teacher be given the opportunity to just basically like jabber on like a mad person for what would be days and days and days and days in order to get through this whole thing. And I don't think that, I mean, the students wouldn't just, they just wouldn't be showing up, you know, at some point, right. Or he'd be like dragged out of the school.
Right.
The thing that I admired about it, became really, tiresome this time for me. And also Hans, I didn't really know what to attribute it to because I wasn't as compelled by the story that he was telling. I was living in the moment of its telling. Mm-hmm. Like I was like, my head was sort of like moving toward the kids in the room. I think that I remember it very vividly with when he's talking about how Mary told him that she didn't have sex with Dick because Dick's penis was too big. And I was like, wow, that must be very interesting in that room. That's going to play real well. And I just couldn't get out of that mode where I was sort of not really in either space. And the other than Price, if you kind of step out of the past, the classroom is a ghost town. You know, it doesn't really like feel like a real space at all. It could be like waiting for Godot. There's nothing happening there other than, you know, Price occasionally talking back. And so I did struggle this time through. I still found the scenes, I think the scenes of the witch performing the swamp shack abortion and Dick, you know, uncovering his own origins and then killing himself are still very striking and beautiful. And they still earn something with me that I really admire. But I do think that the whole path that we take to get to those moments is not as compelling to me anymore.
What I was going to say, I don't know if this matters so much, really. I was going to say that I'm not sure that it's as winding. I don't know that there's any way to resolve this without mapping it out at a level of detail that we don't really have the time or the inclination to do. I don't know if it's necessarily as circuitous as we're making it out to be, right? I mean, there's the timeline of the Atkinson family. There's the timeline of Mary is pregnant in the days around World War II, right? And then there's the timeline of Crick in the modern day. And off the top of my head, I think that those three timelines, 90% of the textual material in those timelines is actually told chronologically, right? Like there's a little bit of a cloud at the beginning and then there's a little bit of a cloud at the beginning where everything's kind of jumbled. But then like once we get going, I think that the events in those timelines are all presented in basically linear fashion off the top of my head.
What about the explication of the eels?
Well, that's just a digression. That's more like a little bit of an essay or something, right? I mean,
Cetology.
Yeah, I actually really liked that.
I liked that part a lot too. That's like you know that he read Moby Dick at some point in.
Yeah,
right. And I love those parts in Moby Dick, too.
Yeah, yeah. That was actually, like, that was maybe the one part that I enjoyed as much. The rambling about the eels was maybe the one part I enjoyed as much on this read as I enjoyed it 10 years ago.
Yeah, I will say that I definitely enjoyed, like, the eel thing.
It's funny because, like, all of the criticisms that I want to make of this novel are things that I don't want to be a person who values the thing that criticism implies, right? I keep wanting to make criticisms and then be like, well, that criticism is establishing a system of aesthetic values that I don't want to be a person who goes around actually caring about and enforcing, mm-hmm. you know, like this thing is, and a lot of these are things that, like, without the question of what happened and why, right? Like, reading it, just knowing all the answers, a lot of these things become more present, but it's so fucking bleak, you know?
Yeah.
And it seems stupidly, pointlessly bleak in a way that does not accurately or authentically reflect the actual bleakness of human life, right?
Mm.
And I don't want to be somebody who has a problem with bleak art, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The objection there must... I think the objection is maybe not that it's bleak. It's that it is... The bleakness feels pointless because the events in these people's lives do not feel authentically human or real world, which means that the bleakness is purely an aesthetic choice rather than something with any meaningful thematic weight, you know?
Maybe I could give a point to it, though, because actually something did jump out to me. What did this story strike you as... Because there's kind of two inciting events, or there's several. There's the war, or the Cold War, and the fear of nuclear war, and Tom Crick looking back at, you know, living in Britain during the early part of World War II when things were looking pretty bleak then as well. There's Lewis, the principal or the superintendent, choosing to end history because it's not important. It's all about the future. And
it's
then
very, very Francis Fukuyama of him.
and then there's Mary stealing the baby. In something about Mary stealing the baby, this story, the kind of like the climax of getting to Mary having a really truly horrible, like, it's still like one of the most gross, striking things I've ever read, abortion scene. And then basically, like, there's like two Marys in this. The Mary as a teenager is like this really interesting, precocious person that, like, has a lot of agency and is very, you know, like, kind of mysterious. And even Tom, like, adult Tom, is sort of like not really sure what to believe about what Mary told him about everything, because she was so precocious and had so much agency. And then we have Mary as an adult who is like none of that. And we don't even really spend time with her. We just sort of like understand that she is very like damaged and has stolen a baby and is being driven by irrational convictions about divinity and or believe not her own divinity, but being guided by divinity. And I feel there's something in that arc that troubles me in how, in its bleakness, in its doominess, for this person who doesn't, is like the way that we're positioned outside of her arc, it doesn't feel like there was anything there was any control over what happened to her or what she became. And that feels really, there's something about that that feel that I have almost, not necessarily a problem with, but I almost wonder if I should have a problem with it, I guess, critically. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that, like, you're right, I believe, that maybe the one truly inexplicable thing is why does a lifetime of strength fail her, right? A lifetime of strength and resolve. And you know, I mean, I think Crick says at one point that she's kind of been, he says pretty explicitly that throughout the marriage, she's been the you know, the strong one. And has supported him much more than he supported her. And why does she go insane? And the question, I guess, is, are you posing the question of, like, on the one hand, you could see the inexplicability of that. On the one hand, you could see that as a craft issue, right? That the maybe the key inciting event to the whole novel, the inciting event which has led to the narrative being told, the fact that that thing is irrational in a basic way and that no effort is made to give it causal, to have causal. Well, it's not that no effort is made, but no understanding is there to be found, right? You can see that as a craft problem, that thing is left unresolved, or you can see it as thematically meaningful, right? And maybe, in fact, something that maybe one of the few thematically meaningful things in the book, right? I mean, it's funny, like, there's a whole lot of thematic symbolism, but there's not much thematic meaning. If that distinction, if that makes sense to you, right? That distinction, and if the key tragedy of the book is truly inexplicable, if the key event of the book, like no coherent history can ever be written of why Mary went crazy after decades of processing trauma in a productive way, right? And maybe that is, and so the whole kind of art of history making, that kind of renders the whole, that the fact that no reasonable story can be told about why she behaves the way that she does renders the whole art of history making in some way false, right? Because Crick cannot understand his own story at the most intimate level. And I kind of like that, actually. I don't know if I agree with it, but this almost isn't the kind of book where, if it has any kind of theme, I don't know if it matters if you agree with it, right? Like, Patrick, I can tell that you've kind of been trying to hold back the urge to, like, disagree intellectually with the ideas being put forward. Yeah. And I'm assuming that the reason that you're holding back from doing that is because you recognize that they are of light enough weight that that would be a pointless exercise.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. I'm holding back because I
feel
like we...
Are you holding back because it's rooted in Marxist dialectics and you think we don't want to hear about that?
No, no. I'm holding back because I feel like we don't do that on this podcast. Mm. I feel like we've established that we don't put forward our own worldview.
Well, I would be curious. I mean, I would be curious to know what the view is of the book that you see as being false, right? And if that involves you explicating your own worldview to some extent, then that's fine. But I'm mostly just wondering, like, the statement that you disagree with, what is the statement that you see that you do disagree with? Is it just that history is chaos that anybody can map any meaning onto?
Well, you know, there are different little sayings throughout the book, like a bunch of different ones that I think I could quibble with. You know, I think I'm in my head, I marked out a couple pages that they were on 140, 167, 204. There were different sayings on each one of those that I thought, well, this, I don't agree with this. But just taking the one I already read, the one on 140. So either this is saying something trivial where he says, you know, we can take any meaning we want. Like he's either saying something trivial, which is that people do in fact, kind of interpret history however they want, whether that's right to do or wrong to do, they do it. That's trivial, and that's because that's just a fact. People do look at history and think, well, this is what this meant. Or he's either saying that, which is just trivial, or he's saying something along the lines of, we should be taking whatever meaning we want out of history, or there is no objective meaning to history, so taking whatever meaning we want is totally fine. And to me, that is objectively incorrect and problematic also. Like, it's not problematic just because it's incorrect. It's problematic because that leads us to thinking that, it leads us towards extending the idea that truth is subjective into other realms as well. And granted that certainly there are events in history that we won't ever know about because we just never find evidence of them, or we don't know why they happened, and that's fine too. You know, maybe we just never will know why a certain thing happened at a certain time. But there are certainly some events that we have good, we can say happened for a very objective reason, and we can be very sure that that's the truth. And I think that is a more ethical position to take. Let's not say anything about the things that we can't say anything about, but agree that there are certain things that we do know.
Sure.
Like why Putin invaded Russia.
Ukraine.
Putin invaded Ukraine. Sorry, yeah. Russia invaded Ukraine.
Well, I'm not actually. I know that it's happening, obviously, but to be honest, I'm kind of ignorant of it all. Like, I don't tend to follow, despite the fact that I call myself an anarchist. Like, I actually don't like to follow politics. Like, it's all very depressing.
What was your point that? You, in making that comparison, Chris, is your point that are you unironically saying that that's a well-understood fact, or is your whole point that actually that is? I mean, I feel like Putin invading Russia is kind of like Mary going crazy and snatching the baby, right? Like there's some little core of inscrutability at the center of it that, you know, can't ever be parsed. And obviously there's been a huge amount of analysis about why, but I've read a lot of it and it all seems very inconclusive. Not at all to go down this, you know, rabbit hole. You know, I'm just curious. I'm really curious which valence you had to that remark.
It was closer to the latter, and also getting at the fact that there is some agency over the meaning that people are attributing to the reasons, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, there's decades and decades of basically characterizing Russia and especially Russian leadership as aggressive and militaristic and heavy-handed. Empire building in a kind of older way. And there's a sort of a counter narrative that exists parallel to the other that, you know, NATO presses upon and is choking Russia constantly. And that these are not the world building empire building machinations of a sort of megalomaniac monster, but a cornered animal lashing out. And I'm not espousing either of those, at all. But I think that actually the more we know about history, the harder it can be to really attribute clear meaning to it in some cases. And I think that that's right, actually. There is this kind of unknowability at the center of this that feels a bit like Mary stealing the baby. But I'm also bringing it up because it's, one of the questions that I had about this book, and we're kind of running out of time. And that has to do with this book coming up for air, stories about impending doom, and where we find ourselves now. I'm, again, also not suggesting that doom is impending, but that's certainly also a narrative that is present right now, and the resurgence of the Cold War. And is there, is there something to these kinds of stories in a time that might be said to resonate with the themes of the stories about doom?
I mean, I'd say that Coming Up for Air would probably resonate a lot more than Waterland would. Again, because Waterland just feels like it occurs in a different world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Coming Up for Air feels like you have such a sense of living in the life and mind of someone who was authentically a person in that time. This actually was a really smart pick to compare to Coming Up for Air, I think, because they do operate in such different ways, right? Like Coming Up for Air is so interested in the texture of day-to-day life, and this novel, for the most part, is so uninterested in the texture of day-to-day life, right? I was saying earlier that there are, like, critiques that I have the urge to make that I don't want to be the kind of person who values that. I don't actually want to go around being someone who thinks that fiction that carefully replicates the texture of, day-to-day life in a time period is the best fiction, right? But between these two works, I did feel as though, in terms of resonating with my own sense of, living in fear of climate change apocalypse and new Cold War and, creeping right-wing authoritarianism, I don't know that I had much of an identifying reaction to either text. I don't think much of my reaction to either text was rooted in, hey, I'm in a time of impending doom too, this resonates, right? But if I were to have that reaction, it feels much more plausible that I could feel that sympathy for Coming Up for Air more so than Waterland.
It just occurred to me that... It occurred to me that, we had chosen these two books in succession, and I was sort of wondering if there was even almost like a, honestly, like a subconscious reason why, these two books came up, when it feels as though, it might even be different if it were like, say, China, but Russia is... Russia as a potential antagonist is kind of a mid-century classical thing, right? It just feels like an older thing. And so I was just kind of curious about it and how that might just sort of impact how we read these stories.
I don't know. I really don't know if current circumstances are making me read these stories in a different way. I mean, they probably are, but I'm not conscious of how it's happening.
I think, Hans, you said, like, Coming Up for Air felt like it was It had the potential to be more resonant in that way because of, we could say, let's journalistic qualities. And then Waterland is so much more ornate and mythologizing that it doesn't quite interface so cleanly with like everyday life. And that really feels like a pretty solid, like, I don't know, that connects for me with maybe like why I wasn't quite, I still really like Waterland. I still really enjoyed it. I still admire it, but I definitely did not feel as like totally captured by it this time. And I think if I read it a fourth time, that downward trajectory would be, you know, further along. And I think that's why.
It doesn't interface with reality.
I think mythology still has to interface with reality. And then this has almost a red herring of interfacing with reality in that, like, the mythology is supposed to be happening in the past that Tom Crick is describing, but then the present that we're occupying also doesn't make sense.
Mm.
You know, it would be one thing if like the past, I don't know. I shouldn't say it would be one thing. I'm just kind of coming to this thought. It feels as though there are too many layers of filigree in between me and the thing and the filigree is very beautiful, and it's and there are specific facets of that I capture beyond it that are extremely striking, but now I'm really just kind of I'm more distracted and pained by the experience of trying to get to those. Now I'm rambling, but I feel like there's something in what you said, Hans, that kind of feels at the center of why I probably won't read this novel again.
Yeah, you know, it's, and I hope we have time for this point. Interrupt me if we don't, but it's been a long time since, like, I remembered really, really enjoying this, and I just always kind of had it in my head as, like, you know, like every now and again somebody asks me to recommend them a book, and it's somebody that I know it doesn't have the same taste that I do, but they want something readable but still smart and literary, and this is a good go-to for that, right? It's pretty much always either this or The Goldfinch when I get that question. And it's been a long time since I really appreciated and admired something and then went back to it and realized, no, actually, I don't much like or admire it at all. And it's a really, it's a bad feeling. I don't like it.
oh, man. Yeah.
And I don't have much to say about it beyond that, you know. I guess, like, a word of warning to readers everywhere. If you have read Waterland, don't reread it. Particularly if you've grown and changed as a human being since last time you read Waterland.
I don't think I'll reread this unless, you know, in 10 years one of you guys
you don't
says
count because you didn't like it.
Oh, okay.
The people who did like it, you know.
That
I think opens the door for your point there about interfacing with lived reality, Chris. I think kind of opens the door for the segue into my pick for next go round.
Nice.
So, cool. I think that the book that I've picked is the exact opposite, I think, of Waterland in a couple of senses, right? You know, Waterland is about someone, and I think actually Coming for Air too, right? Like, Waterland and Coming Up for Air are about someone who is aware of their place of history, is aware of their place in history on a broad scale, and is kind of thinking in large perspectives and timelines. And this is, I think, a novel partly about the sense of being too, almost about the sense of being too entirely within your moment and unable to achieve larger perspective. And
Can we guess?
I'll say also that it's a novel that's entirely about, it's entirely based on the texture of day-to-day reality in the time that it's set, with no sense of anything beyond that minutia, at least in its first half. And it is also a book that I have never mentioned to either of you. So if we've had a conversation about it, it's not the one that I'm thinking of.
I'm not going to try.
You got to try. Patrick, you got to try. I have a guess.
What's your guess?
You guess first, then I'll try.
Leaving Las Vegas.
The book based on the great movie?
No, the movie's based on the book, dude.
That's what I meant. The book that inspired the great movie. Yeah, the book that inspired the great movie.
Unfortunately, I've never read Chris, it. You were wrong.
Okay.
I've never read it either. But I thought about it. I love the movie. So I'm supposed to guess?
If you want to. You don't have to.
Just name one book. Okay. The Sound and the Fury.
I think The Sound and the Fury would be a really interesting example to weigh against Waterland, right? Because it does some of the same things with narrative structure, and it, of course, has a major character who is disabled in a similar way.
Right.
And I loved The Sound and the Fury, but I haven't read it in 10 years, and it's entirely possible I might find it hugely disappointing to come back to in the same way as Waterland. If nothing else, I think it would be interesting to, you know, if we reread The Sound and the Fury and we liked it, the question of, like, why, like, every criticism we've leveled at Waterland could be leveled at The Sound and the Fury, right? So if we read it and we like it, why? But, unfortunately, this episode at least, I am not going to go to The Sound and the Fury. This is a very recent book. It's by Patricia Lockwood. It's called No One Is Talking About This.
No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. Okay.
Hmm. Yep.
I feel like I always repeat the name of the book right after someone says it. Like,
it's an important tradition.
Every time on the podcast.
That's very helpful for the listeners.
Yeah. Patricia Lockwood, No One Is Talking About This. Okay. Cool.
It's the sequel to Everyone Is Talking About This.
Right. Oh. I'll have to read that one first then.
No, they don't have to. It's non-sequential.
Oh, it's non-sequential.
It's in a trilogy. It's in a trilogy with every other person is talking about this.
Oh. It's like McCarthy's Crossing trilogy, which is non-sequential and features different characters. All right.
A checkerboard pattern of people is talking about this.
Okay.
All right. Well, give us the outro, Chris.
All right. Thank you, everybody. And join us next time for... Oh, now I'm confused. Is it Everyone Is Talking About This or no? It's No One Is Talking About This by Patricia Lockwood. Yep. All right. Thanks, guys.
Talk to you later.